Everyone, and welcome to Minute 77 of Season 7 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action film, Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Richard Kirkham of Kirkham Movie A Day, and the Shepherd of the Lambcast. Welcome back to the show, Richard.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here with you and all of your listeners.
Yes, and with McLean and Zeus and, yes, and all those fun people,
and all of the characters in this movie. You know, Simon says, "Answer the questions correctly," and I'm going to try and do that today.
That's right. Jump through hoops. So, minute 77 begins with John seeing what Zeus has spotted, and ends with Jerry trying to prove who he is. So we ended things yesterday with John and Zeus trying to figure out what happened with all the dump trucks. And then Zeus spots one on a road below the FDR drive where they are. And he points it out to John, and John looks, and the first line of this minute is just amazing. Cause John just looks down and goes, "This thing got airbags." And Zeus goes, "Your side does. I don't know about my." And, you know, we're actually going to stop it right there before we continue with what's going on, because, you know, airbags. We got to talk about airbags.
Oh, well, I'm happy to talk about airbags.
Okay. Do you know anything about airbags?
Hey, I know a little bit about the history of when airbags were introduced and when they became required in automobiles. And what the whole purpose of them was. It was a subject that came up regularly when I was in college, and it was kind of connected to one of the debate topics we covered 1 year. So,
oh wow, very cool.
A lot of fun.
Why don't you enlighten us, Richard?
Well, airbags were developed in the 1970s, primarily in response to the fact that people were not wearing their damn seatbelts. All cars sold in the United States were required to have seatbelts starting in 1966. Many of them had seatbelts before that, but they're all required to have seatbelts in 1966. But after 10 years of promoting them, public safety announcements, encouraging people, showing people the consequences of not wearing their seatbelts, seatbelt usage was never more than 15 to 20%. So they're you know, technology gets better. They're always looking for a way to improve safety. Before we had the seatbelt laws that made it mandatory to wear seatbelts, one of the solutions was, well, let's try this. And they created the airbag as a way to kind of supplement it. The airbag, by the way, is a supplement. It's not a replacement for a seatbelt, because it works, you know, very quickly. And it's not going to stop some of the injuries that you have. But auto companies resisted it quite a bit because it's an expensive item to add to automobiles, and it increases the price of the car, and consumers were not in huge demand of it. Nowadays, of course, it's standard in cars. It's required in automobiles, and there are very different versions of airbags. I'm trying to remember. I saw an episode of, maybe it was CSI one time, that made reference to an interesting phenomena that was one of the arguments made against installing airbags. And that was research that came from Professor Sam Peltzman at the University of Chicago, who discovered that the safer you made the occupants of the vehicle, the more increase there was in accidents and greater number of fatalities of pedestrians, because people, when they feel safer, they drive more recklessly.
Oh, yeah, that's not good.
Yeah, you know, and whether or not it would be a proportionate turnaround, it's probably not the case. But it does. There is this tendency when people look, I always use the example when I was talking about this. You know, when my tires were bad, and by the way, when I was a college student, my tires were always bad on the car. I bought cheap used tires. And when I would go through them, and sometimes you could see the threads of the steel belt in them, and I'd be driving on those. I would slow down
especially
early.
Especially when you get stranded in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, I would slow down early and drive.
Do you remember telling me that story?
Breaking her? No, yes, I think I did when I broke down in the middle of nowhere.
That's right. And you had to get someone to, because the tires were not standard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But yeah, this was a different kind of thing. But I, you know, you're very careful when you do that. You get brand new tires on your car, and suddenly you're going around the curve, you know, twice as fast as you used to do, because you know that you can take the curve without having to worry too much about it. And there was a fear that airbags would have that effect on people, that they would think suddenly, well, I'm safer, so I can take more chances while driving. But airbags became standard. You know, the mandatory seatbelt law started going into effect in the early 80s. And I think by 1985, all the states except one had mandatory seatbelt laws in the U.S. And airbags became standard also in the early 1980s. So you got simultaneous implementation of mandatory seatbelt laws and the presence of airbags in cars automatically, which did substantially reduce the number of fatalities. We had probably, you know, 55,000 people dying on the highways in the early 1970s every year in car accidents. You still have way more people than you want to die in these accidents. I haven't checked the numbers recently, but by the 1990s, the numbers were half that, even though the population of drivers was substantially higher.
Right. Well, I'm impressed that you remember all this stuff from your debate from 45 years ago.
Well, like I said, I can remember conversations from 5 decades ago, but it's a little bit tough sometimes to remember what I was doing this morning.
So I just have a little statistic here from between 1990 and 2000. How many people died by the airbag itself, by the deployment of the airbag?
Accidental deployment of airbags or a deployment?
No, no.
Deployment. In their injury.
That resulted in death.
Where the airbag caused the death, is that's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that is a complication, too, that sometimes happens. I would guess a couple hundred.
175.
Okay.
And close. More than 100 of those were children.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that the kids were moved to the back seats.
That's
in
right.
Cars, and you've got a switch on cars to turn off the passenger side airbag.
Correct. So if we talk about 175 fatalities during that 10-year period, how many times do you think how many airbags were deployed during that decade?
Oh, probably 20,000, 30,000.
3.3 million.
Okay. I was thinking a year, by the way. So,
okay.
So I'd be closer to maybe 300,000, and I would still be at 10% of the deployments. By the way, have you ever been in a car where the airbags have deployed?
Thankfully, no.
I have. Airbags are, you know, violent, and they burn you, and it's not an easy experience to go through.
You're still here to talk about it.
No, I was glad I was glad I had the airbag. It made a difference, prevented more severe injury, but I did have burns on my hands and arms. Not severe, you know, first and second degree kind of burns that go on there. So.
Oh, wow. How long ago was this?
Oh, this was 1998. We had a... We T-boned a car that ran a stop sign. Actually, there wasn't a stop sign. It came out from under a bridge. We couldn't see it. We didn't have a stop sign. I don't know if they had a stop sign or not, but they pulled right in front of us. They came out from under a bridge that we couldn't see them until we were, well, like I said, until they were right there. And all four of us were in the car at the time. And my wife and I in the front seat, the airbags deployed there. The kids were in the back seat. They were fine. But it was, you know, my car was totaled. And, you know, replacing airbags is expensive, too. By the way, airbags are often stolen.
Really?
Yeah. People steal airbags like they steal catalytic converters. There's an aftermarket for it, apparently.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And by the way, since we're talking about airbags in this scene, he asked about the airbags. You notice that the airbag doesn't deploy.
Correct. That is correct. Well, we'll get there in a second. There's even more questions that can be asked. about the fact that the airbag didn't deploy. And then the shot changes, and we see the BMW flying through the air. You know, he crashes through the, you know, the barrier from the FDR, and I would say he falls a good, what would you say, about 50, 60 feet?
It's a long way, you know. Maybe 50 is a little high. It's 20 to 30 feet, you know, when you're thinking about an overpass. That's kind of what you would be thinking, you know, would be standard on an underpass would be, you know, 15 feet, and then you would maybe add a couple of feet on top of that. So that would be my guess, but it's still a long way.
Right. So we basically see this car flying through the air, landing on the ground, and continues driving, which I don't think is possible, but it's good that you pointed out the fact that the airbags didn't deploy. Now, I mean, it goes back to the question of how does Zeus know that for sure that John has an airbag and he doesn't?
Well, I'm assuming he's not sure that he's doing. I'm assuming because it's a Mercedes.
Okay.
And a relatively new car.
Right. Okay. That is fair.
You know, and like I said, airbags, when they were put into cars, it was an incremental process. You know, they didn't have airbags for all of the seats in the cars. They didn't always have them for the passengers when they first put them in. They also now have airbags in the headspace as well. So they've got side airbags. So it's a little bit different. It's not quite Demolition Man foam filling the car, but there are a lot of things that can protect you in an automobile accident. But in 1995, probably you'd be confident that the driver's side airbag existed. And my guess would be that there would be a passenger side airbag, but you know, maybe Zeus just doesn't know his Mercedes-Benz models as well as the rest of the world does.
Maybe. That's definitely a possibility. But you notice also that they cut off a truck as, you know, which theoretically, you know, in real life, that truck would have just plowed through them.
it was dangerous. The whole, you know, the truth of the matter is none of it is plausible.
No, not at all. It's fun to watch, but
it looks good on the screen, but it's not plausible at all.
That's right. And I mean they like skid around and then just keep driving, and he catches up to the truck pretty easily, which is pretty impressive. John knows how to drive.
Yes, and apparently Mercedes have fantastic suspension.
At least in this world, they do. And at this point, we see the dump truck continue to go down the street, and then John, you know, is in this beat up car, swerving back and forth, trying to catch up to him. He finally catches up to him, passes him, and then cuts him off by putting, you know, the BMW in the way of the truck continuing to, you know, to go down the street. And then John jumps out of the car and in a smooth way pulls out his gun as he's doing that, walks around, you know, like tiptoes around the car on his way to the truck itself, which is pretty interesting the way that he does it. And then he screams, "In the truck, let me see your hands. Put them on the door." Yeah, I guess this must be like standard police procedure for how you take down a truck driver, you know. And I love how Zeus is just like casually strolling up and watching this whole thing going on.
Yeah, with his head cocked sideways and checking out the situation there.
Exactly. And then you know, John opens the door. First of all, before he opens the door, he actually he puts his hand up that Zeus should stop where he is, and then he opens the door, and we see a guy lying on the lying on the floor of this truck, and he goes, "Don't kill me, don't shoot me," and then John goes, "You the truck driver?" And he goes, "No, I'm a beautician. Of course I'm a truck driver."
Yeah, another one of those things that you you could do it in a movie, but if somebody was pointing a gun at you and this was all happening, you would not make the smart ass comment.
I know. No, exactly. That was the point I was going to make. This is, you know, not the smartest thing to do, especially if you don't know who it is that's after you here.
Yeah.
So this is a character that we're going to see through the rest of this week, and he pops up next week also. His name is Jerry Parks, and he is played by an actor named Joe Zaloom, Zaloom, born on the 30th of July, 1942. He is mostly a Broadway actor and only has 19 IMDb credits. From what I saw, this was the most prominent role that he's had. You know, most of them are just small little roles and stuff like that because he gets to make a joke about it being a beautician. You know, I guess.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Yeah, but again, this isn't the best time for comedy. And then John says, "Where are you taking this truck?" And he goes, "The aqueduct." And then he goes, "What are you taking a dump truck to the racetrack for?" So are you familiar with the racetrack known as the Aqueduct?
I've heard of it. I am not familiar with it because I don't live in New York and don't follow the horse races. But I had heard of it before, yes.
Have you ever been to a horse race?
I have. Santa Anita was in the – it was, you know, just 4 miles from where I lived for most of my life. And I went to the racetrack a couple of times, and also they had horse racing at the county fair, but I was never into that scene. I have friends who did that quite a bit, and I had older relatives. That was their weekly Sunday activity. It was going to the racetrack, and Santa Anita was their local racetrack. So,
oh, wow.
That was not my world at all.
Okay, so the Aqueduct racetrack was first built in 1894. So it's been 129 years that it's been around. It is a thoroughbred.
So it's 4 years older than Cantuna.
Apparently, yes. So the Aqueduct racetrack is a thoroughbred horse racing facility and casino in the Jamaican neighborhood of Queens. And it is the only racetrack located within New York City limits. And usually you have races from October, early November through April. And there is a casino right next door known as the Resorts World New York City. And they have three different courses there that are used. And it is also the headquarters of the New York Racing Association, which I guess makes sense. Jerry says to him, "No, the aqueduct, the water aqueduct." And then John goes, "Aqueduct?" You know, he's just very like confused as to what Jerry is talking about. Now, here's something that I never noticed before. So the truck basically continues, and you know he's giving John a ride, and John is basically standing on the outside of the truck. Meaning that they must be really close to where they need to be in the aqueduct, you know, for him to just hang on to the truck.
Yeah, and I didn't think they would drive a long distance with him, you know, straddling the step up there. Yeah,
exactly. And then Jerry starts explaining and says, "See, it goes from here." And then, you know, we get a shot like of this map. Then that's pretty much how the minute ends. So did you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
Well, you know, the whole discussion of the aqueduct is what we ought to be talking about. It gets introduced here. I looked up the aqueduct. It is the largest construction project in New York's history. And here's something that's cool. It's still being worked on. It's not scheduled to be finished until 2032.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. I was actually holding off to talk about this when Jerry gives us his little tour to the whole thing, but that's fine also. So there are four tunnels, and the tunnel that they're talking about here is tunnel number three, which at the time that this movie was being made, they were at, only stage one of the third tunnel was completed.
Right, Jerry does explain that in the next minute.
That's right. That's right. I think it's on Thursday that he mentions it. So the water tunnel number one was completed in 1917. Water tunnel number two was completed in 1936. Water tunnel number three started construction in 1970. And they opened parts of it in 1998, which means that when this movie came out, it still wasn't completely opened. And then other parts of it were opened in 2013. And as you said, will only be completed in 2032. The tunnel itself will be more than 60 miles long, and it's 500 feet below street level at certain points. And the eventual cost, which again could change, at this point, it's over $6 billion. For this thing. And so they have stage four, which is proposed, but they haven't even started that one yet. So
it's a big public works project.
Yes. Now, how many people do you think have died since they started digging out water tunnel number three?
I mean, working on the project?
Yeah, fatalities, not just how many people have died since 1970, Richard?
Yeah, that would be a lot.
Yes. Let me rephrase that question. How many people?
3,000 a day times 365 days times 57 years, a lot.
That's no, right. So let me rephrase the question.
Yeah.
How many fatalities have there been in the construction project since they started doing this in 1970?
Oh, you know, I'm sure that there have been a few, but I'm just guessing. 20?
24. Very good.
All right.
Okay, 23 of them were workers, and the final one was a 12-year-old boy who was playing around an area that he shouldn't have and fell in and died from the fall. Site.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But since 1997... knock on wood, there has not been any fatalities. So all of these happened beforehand.
Very good. Yep. They have a sign somewhere on the construction site that says, how many days without a fatality.
That's right.
That's good.
Last fatality in 1997. All right. So the script from this minute begins with. So we ended yesterday in the script with John and Zeus having a discussion about where the next exit was. And then John says, "I beg to differ." And then he turns to him and goes, "This thing have airbags?" McLean slams on the brakes and throws the wheel. The Mercedes fishtails into the left-hand lane. "Yeah, why?" McLean, "Ah, shit." McLean throws the wheel again. The Mercedes smashes through the guardrail and flies into the southbound lane of the FDR. Oncoming cars screech, locking up their brakes as the Mercedes roars across the three southbound FDR lanes, smashes through the far guardrail, and careens widely onto 86th Street. McLean throws the wheel, power sliding into a U-turn. He floors it and speeds after the dump truck. The Mercedes closes on the dump truck. McLean and Zeus, that McLean and Zeus saw from the FDR. The Mercedes overtakes the dump truck, then swerves in front of it, screeching to a stop, blocking it. The dump truck stops. McLean and Zeus get out. McLean approaches the dump truck, gun drawn, hollering, "Get your hands up and get the fuck out." The terrified driver throws up his hands. He gets out of the cab, quivering. "Dad, take it easy." McLean, still training the gun on the driver, backs up towards the bed of the dump truck. He climbs onto the bumper and looks into the truck bed. It's empty. McLean steps down from the bed, lowering his gun. He flips out his detective shield. "Where are you going?" "Central Park, the aqueduct construction." "The New York City Aqueduct? Can you drive one of these things through it?" "That's all I've been doing for the last 5 years." McLean's brain sparks with understanding. It's all clear to him now. He turns to Zeus, and that's it. So, again, I like it the way they do it in the movie a little better, despite the beautician comment.
Yeah.
Jerry is a very memorable character in this movie. So, They took out part of the memorable stuff from him, but we'll see if later in the week we're going to get, information. We're going to get those trivia tidbits from Jerry. Who knows? Every Tuesday we have a segment called Trilogy Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five movie trilogies. So, Richard, what have you got for us?
Well, this was a tough one because when I went to look at movie trilogies and I found a whole bunch of them that I really liked. And there's one right now that I'm a big fan of, but I'm waiting for the third film. I haven't seen it yet. By the time this episode is posted, it'll be up. I assume it's going to match up to the others and might have cracked my top five if I had actually seen it. So I excluded it for that reason. That's the X trilogy, X, Pearl, and Maxine. So that's kind of a runner up. And I had to take off a couple of others that I think are terrific trilogies. I like the Kingsman films. I'm a big fan of the action films, the Equalizer and the Fallen series, and the animated How to Train Your Dragon series has got three films. So those were all films that I thought, oh, I would really like to include them. But I decided to stick with what I think are the best, the most important, the ones that I've seen the most, the ones that I care the most for. And so at number five, I've got the Dollars trilogy, the spaghetti westerns from Sergio Leone, Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I'm a huge Clint Eastwood fan, and those movies are, you know, like the starting point of his major career. You know, it worked before. He obviously had a TV series, but this is when he broke out as a movie star. And they're all terrific films. At number four, I have the Dark Knight trilogy, Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, and The Dark Knight Rises. I think that this is one of the best attempts to create a real world version of superheroes that you can get. There's a little bit of exaggeration here and there with what somebody might be capable with the technology, but nobody here has superpowers. Everybody is a human being. They have different motivations and different capabilities because of things that exist in the real world. So I think that, you know, the Christopher Nolan films are just solid. At number three, I've got the original Star Wars trilogy, which probably changed the movies the most for any trilogy that we've talked about. You know, it's the thing that, you know, the original Star Wars drew kids to movies, changed the lives of so many future movie makers, you know, inspired them in ways that is still reflected back nowadays. And I think, you know, they're all high quality films. I've seen all of them multiple times. I do prefer, of course, the original versions as opposed to the ones that have been tinkered with by George Lucas. I still think, or Han shoots first, not Greedo. So we got to get that straight. Then number two is the Lord of the Rings series from Peter Jackson. I was a huge Lord of the Rings fan when I was a teenager reading the books. I looked forward to the animated movie when it came out. I had always hoped that they would produce a movie like that. In fact, when I saw The Empire Strikes Back, I thought that's the way they could do this movie. They could use puppets like Yoda to do the characters in the Lord of the Rings films, if they ever do that. And of course, that was well before we had CGI, and that's, I think, what made it easier to do. I don't want to say easy to do, because I know it was a huge challenge to do them, to turn them into a film series. But when the technology came along and was able to create the visualizations necessary to bring this world into ours, I thought that Peter Jackson did a fantastic job. And then at the top are the, you know, three films, one of which gets hugely criticized, but it's a very good film despite its flaws. The other two are perfect, and that's the Godfather trilogy, the Godfather,
yeah,
Godfather
I knew Part you were 2, going there.
And Godfather 3. You know, the Godfather and Godfather 2 are two of my favorite films of all time. I resisted doing a top 10 list of favorite films for years. I finally did it about 4 years ago, and The Godfather and Godfather 2, I cheated. I put them together as one film, and they easily made my top five. The Godfather Part 3 is not as good, but that doesn't mean that it's not good. There's a lot of good stuff in it, and it's a quality piece, and I like Andy Garcia in the film, and Joe Mantegna are, they're not the lead characters, but they are good characters in this plot. Sofia Coppola gets the blame for a lot of the faults of this film. I think she looks right, but she's not really a great actress, and that's one of the things that makes it a little bit tough. But still, you know, when you've got Godfather and Godfather Part 2, as two-thirds of your trilogy, you're ahead of 90% of everything else.
Yeah, That's definitely true. All right. Great list. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Why don't you once again tell people where they can find Richard Kirkham?
My personal website is Kirkham A Movie A Day. I have both a blogger site and a WordPress site, easily accessible if you just Google Kirkham A Movie A Day. No problems there. I'm also the host of the Lambcast, and I am the current shepherd of the Lamb, which is the large association of movie blogs. The Lambcast has a weekly podcast that brings together members of our organization to talk about movies every week. We do new films, we do retrospectives, we've got a movie of the month, we've got draft shows that we do. It's just film fans having a good time talking about movies, which is exactly what Rob and I are doing here. So you can find us by searching largeassmovieblogs.com or Lambcast on any of the socials.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. You can send me an email to movierobminute@movierob.net, or you can visit my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay, everybody.
Marching home again, hurrah, hurrah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.